Mr. Mulkey?
Yes, ma'am.
Could you please start by stating your full name and your ADC number for the record?
My name is Eric Allen Mulkey. My DOC number is 113208.
Thank you, sir. You're appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency for for consideration of general parole, home arrest, or absolute discharge today.
Thank you.
And I'd like to introduce you to the members of the board. If you look on the video screen to your right, so my left, at the very end is the Honorable Lee Quinones. Next to him is the Honorable Dave Neal. Right next to me here in the middle is the Honorable Dr. C.T. Wright, our board chair. And over on my other side here is the Honorable Michael Johnson. My name's Gail Rittenhouse. I'll conduct your hearing today. I'll start with, this is your first hearing before the board, right, sir?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I'll start with just some review of just some facts, and then I'll give you the opportunity. If I say anything wrong, I'll let you correct me on record. It appears you're doing, you're 44 years old right now, sir?
That's correct.
Okay. And you're serving 25 years to life of a crime of murder in the first degree, and that occurred on June 29th, 1994, and when you were about 20 years old when that happened?
That's correct.
Okay. And it appears you had two other sentences, an armed robbery for 10 and a half years and a theft for 1.5 years, and those have since expired. And you were convicted, it looks like, by jury trial on March 7th, 95, and sentenced on May 22nd, 1995. Is that correct, sir?
Right, yes, I believe so.
Okay, and did you appeal your conviction?
Yes, ma'am, I did.
Okay, and the appeal was upheld then? As far as you know, it was upheld?
The appeal was upheld?
The conviction was upheld?
Correct.
Okay, all right, thank you, sir. Okay, it looks like you have kind of moderate history in prison of discipline. It looks like you've had 18 majors, sir. And your most recent was October 21st of 15, and that was a refused to program. That was a major. Right before that, there was a minor September of 2015 for tampering with a security device. And Mr. Mulkey has completed quite a bit of programming. I see substance abuse course. Taking Design for Living a few times, Thinking for a Change 2 times, and then quite a few, in addition to functional literacy and a GED. Did you finish your GED, sir, while you were in prison?
Yes, ma'am, in 99.
You finished it? Okay. And then since then, you've taken an impressive amount of trade skills, trades classes, cement finishing, it looks like.
Started over.
I'm sorry.
Sir? You just need to start it over.
This was never supposed to start until I arrived.
Okay, so
I've waited 25 years for this. It needs to be started over.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, let me just explain a couple things to you, sir, because we were going off the information that we have.
You can explain it to me.
Okay, so we start.
I'm the wife and I'm the victim.
Yes, ma'am. We understand that. And so,
I made all the arrangements.
And so we just started this about 2 minutes ago. All that we've done.
I'm sorry, why would you start without me? You're not supposed to start without
me. Absolutely right.
We have been victim's witness for years in Cochise County, and we do not start without the victim. I made all the arrangements with Alex. These children could have let me know they were coming. I would come at any hour they wanted me to come, because I was the one who notified them that they should be here.
Okay. Hold on.
I didn't notify you. I sent you two emails.
Excuse me. I understand that you're upset. I truly do. Okay, we started the hearing about a minute ago. The hearing was originally scheduled for 12:30.
But that's when I was going to be here. I'm accommodating them.
We scheduled that, sir. Would you just let me?
I accommodated 12:30.
Miss, if you would please just let me finish. I understand what you're saying. Just please let me finish. I'm trying to explain something to you, okay? I do understand about you being upset. We were informed that the hearing was supposed to start at 12:30. Then we got the information that there were some people here that had a 1 o'clock flight that they had to leave, and they asked to move it up to 11 o'clock, that we were told that you had been informed that it was going to be moved to 11 o'clock, that you were driving here, you were en route to driving here, and I'm just, you were en route to driving here. And so we went ahead, we moved the hearing up to 11, we started this hearing a few minutes ago. The only thing that has occurred during this hearing, at this point in time, right now, the only thing that has occurred during this hearing is that he's been introduced. He's gone over some information with him about with it, but there's not. We start the hearing over again. There's very little that can be done. There's been no testimony on behalf of Mr. Loki. There's been no testimony on behalf of any of the victim witnesses. We have not discussed what the issues were. We've just gone over some minor details that we have to go over in order to start the hearing. So you have not missed out on any vital portions of the hearing.
May I say something now?
Yes.
You may not start anything unless the victim is present.
Mr. Johnson, why don't we just start over and so that we can move this hearing forward?
And also, I want it for other victims.
Other victims?
When a victim...
Is other victims on their way?
Has to be present before you start.
Are any other victims on their way, ma'am?
I'm sorry?
Any other victims on their way now for this hearing?
No.
Okay, then may I respectfully...
Who's Alex? Is Alex here? Are you Alex?
No.
You're Alex. Yes, ma'am. Okay. Who made all the arrangements, Alex? Who made all the phone calls to you, Alex?
I just kept in close contact.
My address was kept with you, because I knew how important all this was. And I asked you not to start without me, did I not? So what made you start without me?
Now we're going to
start over.
As chairman of the board, we will start over, and everything will move forward from the beginning. So as chairman of the board, I am going to request the Honorable Mr. Johnson and the Honorable Ms. Rittenhouse if they will start from the beginning of this hearing. And so you will miss absolutely nothing. So we're starting over at this moment.
Appreciate that.
Mr. Mulkey? We need to restart your hearing, so we will start at this point. And would you please state your full name and your ADC number for the record?
My name is Eric Mulkey. My ADC number is 113208.
Thank you, sir. You're appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency for consideration today for general parole, home arrest, or absolute discharge. I'd like to introduce you to the members of the board conducting the hearing. If you look to your right, my left.
That's fine. We've already
right.
That's fine.
Okay. The Honorable Lee Quinones, the Honorable David Neal. Next to me, the Honorable Dr. C.T. Wright. On my other side, the Honorable Michael Johnson. My name is Gail Rittenhouse. I'll conduct your hearing.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, sir. And so I'll start by reviewing a few facts with you and ask you to correct me, although I think I have them correct at this point. You're 44 years old and currently serving a 25-year-to-life sentence for the crime of murder in the first degree, which occurred on June 29, 1994, when you were 20 years old. You had also committed and been convicted of an armed robbery, which is 10.5 years, and a theft, which was 1.5 years. Both of those have since expired. You were convicted by a jury on March 7th, 1995, and sentenced on May 22nd, 1995. And I asked you if you appealed your conviction, and you said yes, and then we established that your conviction had been upheld by an appeal.
That is my understanding.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. And then I mentioned that you had a moderate, prison discipline history, and you had 18 majors, with your last discipline being in October 21st, 2015, for refusing to program, which is considered a major. And the one right before that was September 1st, 2015, which was tampering with a security device, and that was a minor. At this point then, and we were also looking at your program history in the Department of Corrections, and I mentioned that you completed substance abuse, three times Design for Living programs, two Thinking for Change, and you participated in functional literacy and completed your GED while you've been in prison. And then I mentioned that you had also completed an impressive number of trades classes. Cement finishing, computer, wood finishing, two times masonry, horticulture, and an auto, was that auto mechanic? Or, it just says auto. So I'm not sure.
I'm not sure what that was. There was no auto mechanic.
So you didn't take that? Okay, I'm not sure what.
Plumbing. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Were you in construction before you came to prison?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
Not legally.
Okay, but you have learned possibly learned some construction trade things.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right, sir. Let's see. What else was I going to review before we start? I think that's it. We have present in the room, as I mentioned, this is your first hearing, so you're probably not familiar with exactly how they go. But we have supporters for you today, sir. But we have a number of victims in the room. We have four victims who have signed in, and it appears we have five people that in the room. Okay, so we have four victims. So, Mr. Mulkey, parole hearings are an opportunity for you to, you know, you to talk to the board and for us to get to know you. And what we'll want to do, we'll talk some about the crime itself, sir. We want to hear from you what happened that day and what was going through your mind. But we also,
for the opportunity.
Okay, sir. But we also want to talk to you about your plans, you know, kind of what you have in mind if you were to be paroled, and kind of why, how you're different. Certainly everybody's different now than they were 20 years ago. So we'll be interested in hearing your viewpoint on how you feel you're different. But why don't you start by telling us what happened that day, sir? What happened the day of the crime?
How I got up that morning was picked up by a friend who had no interest in going to work or anything else. I was a better phrase, at his mercy, because it was his job, it was his setup, the whole nine yards, so I was just going along. I didn't even know that he had already been told that there was no reason for him to show up to work, so.
What was the job? What work were you doing?
We were working for a neighbor of his family's. And basically anything that man needed, we were there for: tightening the fence, clearing brush, painting, moving furniture, the whole kit and caboodle.
So it was kind of like ranch work and maintenance?
No, not at all.
No?
No, ma'am. We were helping a friend move.
Okay. All right, so what happened then?
We ended up at his grandparents' house where he was talking about golf and stuff, and I was talking about going to the swimming pool. If we were going to just skip work, if it was, you know, his family, friends, I don't know. So So he was like, well, then we're taking alcohol. So we broke into his grandparents' cabinet. We took a bottle of vodka, took a carton of orange juice, a thermos, and I commenced to mix an ice on the way up the mountain. And once I realized we were nowhere near the swimming pool, I was like, where are we going? We're going to go drink alcohol in the middle of the desert? Sorry. We went back to his family's house, and he said he had forgotten something, and I honestly thought that he forgot his cigarettes, but I mean, he came back with a loaded weapon and a whole bunch of bullets and a sock. And put them in the golf cart, and we took off. By that time, I was drinking heavily on this thermos that was never even found. I mean, they can't even ever say that any of my testimony even exists because it's basically just lies, discontent, deceit. So we ended up in somebody else's backyard. We broke into that house, and he proceeded down the hallway, screaming and yelling. And then, oh yeah, well, I picked up the weapon that he used to bust in the glass screen door, and I picked up the weapon to make sure that he could get back out, honestly, and that, you know, that weapon wasn't turned against us. So we're standing there waiting. I mean, I had seen him a couple times put this weapon up to his face and pull the trigger. So I was like, is it loaded? Is it not loaded? I don't care, but I closed the trigger and it blew a hole in the floor. Why I didn't take off my toe, I do not know, but it was enough to scare him out of there. He went running by me, snatched the weapon, and was gone. I just turned around and moseyed right back out behind him. By the time I caught up to him, he was yelling about shooting me, and we didn't have enough alcohol and all kinds of other stuff, and I was like, the thermos is right back there, Buzz. Anytime you want to, we can go. And he was like cursing at me and throwing stuff, and I was like, whatever you want to do, man. I'm pretty sure that that guy works, or I mean, his house is like maybe a quarter mile from where we are right now, so we can go back to work. If you want to go to work, we need to go to work, or I need to go do something else, because this is stupid. And and he was like, you want to see stupid? And he took off. So now I'm following his footprints through the sand. As irritated as I was too drunk to really actually even care to even go find my own family and friends or anything else. And I knew, you know, even if I had, smelling the way I did, nobody is going to want to listen or have anything to do with me. Yeah, basically that's when I heard a gunshot. I walked up on the road, and he was coming back at me with a weapon. I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, get in the car. I'm like, no, I'm going this way. He's like, I got us a ride. You got us a ride. What are you talking about? Get in the car. I got in this stupid car. We went up the mountain. At one point, he turned around, and he turned around, drove back, and came back with a wallet, a man's wallet, and he threw it in my lap, and he said, here, go through this, see if there's anything worth anything, and he was driving off. And I was like, I don't see anything. I don't know what you did, man. Who you scared off or whatever. And he's like, don't even worry about that. Get rid of it. Throw it. I threw the wallet. And we went to his girlfriend's house, which I guess this girl was even younger than he was. I assumed that they were in the back, honestly, having sex, doing whatever. She had her little brother she was babysitting, so I was stuck in the middle of their living room by myself with a stolen vehicle, with his gun, everything else, and just trying to think, am I drunk or am I dreaming? What is this? I don't understand. He comes back out, you know, which is 45 minutes later, and he's like, oh, let's go, all right, yay, we're having fun. To where I guess, according to her statements, they were writing letters to their friends about how he was going to commit suicide, and that he needed money for the car, for gasoline or whatever.
So Mr. Monkey, what was your relationship with this? Was he older than you or younger than you?
At the time, I thought we were the same age.
Okay.
I only found out later on that, he was at least 3 years younger than me.
Younger than you. And had you been friends or just co-workers or?
Correct. We were acquaintances. I think my sister may have babysat him at one point years ago.
Okay. And why did you, I mean, when you realized, I mean, you've already said once, you realized that what he was doing was wrong. Why did you try to stop him?
Ma'am, no, I did not try to stop him at all.
And do you have any thoughts about why?
Today is the same. He had a weapon. There was nothing, honestly, I've over the last 25 years, I've contemplated this from both sides, as if there was no co-defendant, as if the weapon was in my hand, as if it was the victims that are probably sitting in front of you. They're watching this whole scene. I've contemplated every single nuance of avenues that could be thought of. And to this day, there is no way. There's nothing I could have done to stop any of this.
Do you know what happened to your co-defendant? Or you don't know what's happened to him? I know it's probably hard to get information where you are, but...
I wouldn't care less if he was my neighbor.
Hmm. Okay, sir. I'm going to see if my fellow board members have questions for you at this point. Mr. Johnson has a question for you.
So, looking at the file, when you guys were apprehended and arrested, your co-defendant stated that it was you who did the shooting. Is that your understanding?
I have no doubt.
He says that it was you who did the shooting. The story is a little bit different than the story that you're actually telling, sir.
Okay.
So you say you had no doubt. You weren't aware of the statements that he made?
Right. We were split up.
Okay. But after you got your attorney and you had the opportunity to talk with your attorney, you wasn't made aware that your co-defendant had made statements or alleged that you were the one who actually did the shooting?
Correct.
So this will be the first time that you ever heard that your co-defendant alleged that you were the one who did the shooting?
No.
When was the first time? So 36 hours later, you heard that your co-defendant was saying that it was you who actually did the shooting?
Right.
And it's your statement at this time that you were there, but you weren't involved in the actual shooting itself?
That's correct. I did not tell him to do this. I did not say, hey, there's a vehicle, let's go for a drive. I did not say, don't do it. I didn't have a chance to even know that this had happened. I had heard a gunshot, which was very distinct from, I don't know, a quarter mile.
So why did you...
Yes, sir?
Go ahead.
Goodness gracious. Yes, sir, there was nothing I could have done to keep this from happening. There's nothing I could have done to keep him from shooting himself, shooting me, shooting the officer that arrested us. Once we were on the road, I mean, there are signs along the road, any highway, that says no hitchhiking. I went directly to the road, I started hitchhiking, knowing full well that we're going to get stopped, and he's either going to shoot me, which at that point I did not care, honestly. I don't care to this day. But better that than him shooting this officer or whatever, but I had to get away from him. And I figured if he didn't want to get picked up, he would go another direction. I was going to get picked up by somebody, and I was going to be on my way.
Okay, so at the time that you guys were stopped by the police and you guys were hitchhiking, you guys had made up a story why you guys were out on the road hitchhiking, but subsequently, it says that your co-defendant informed the officers about the homicide that you guys had been involved in. And
who did? I'm sorry, excuse me?
Your co-defendant. The person who was with you.
Oh, public defender?
No, your co-defendant. The gentleman who was with you.
Okay.
So, when the officers were arrested, did you have bullets in your pocket?
Yes, sir, I did.
So when did you wind up with those bullets in your pocket, sir, if you never had the weapon?
Those were taken out of the golf cart. And that's how I knew there was a sock around. It was an actual athletic sock that I poured out of the sock and into my fatigue style pockets of BDUs, battle dress, fatigues.
So when you guys were arrested and taken back to where the gun was found, did you show the police officers where the gun was located?
That's correct, I did.
You showed them where the gun was located, and who put the gun there?
Basically, we were fighting over who had said that, evidently, because I was in one vehicle, and he was in another squad vehicle, and when we pulled up, we were evidently both saying, it's right there, because I guess they said that I had it on me, and I told them, do I look like I have it on me? And the officer laughed at me, and he was like, well, no. And I was like, well, I don't know what to tell you, but let's go back to the scene, arresting, where the officer had picked us up for trying to find out what the heck these two idiots, kids, are doing on the down highway playing, you know.
So
let's go hitchhiking.
So, sir, if you did not have a gun and you were not involved in it, how were you able to be the one to tell the police officers where the gun was? That's what the report says, that you told the police officers where the gun was.
Sir, if it was not on my person, and it was not on my co-defendant's person, then it had to have been, well, the last time I saw the weapon was, let's see, right before he jumped the fence to follow me to go hitchhiking.
So that's how you were able to tell take the police and tell them where the gun was in the bushes or the shrub or whatever was out there?
Yes, sir, just right there in the grass by the side of the road.
So that was because you guys had hopped the fence and that's the last location that you guys were at? Is that your statement?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
All right, so I don't have it anymore. Thank you, Mr. Rittenhouse.
Thank you.
Mr. Quinones has
Thank you, Ms. Rittenhouse. Mr. Mulkey, I want to address a different part of the whole of your case, and that is, it seems like you had a wide variety of infractions inside the Department of Corrections.
Yes, sir.
And we're always careful about this because we recognize there are security issues, but it seems like you had some SDG affiliation. Is that correct?
Many.
Okay. When did this, are you still active, or when did that change?
I have been approached for recruitment many times. The actual changing, I guess, as you would say, would be when they found out about the probably 2002, when I don't know, the truth in sentencing or the unfortunate 500 clauses were written.
So, did you step down from membership?
Sir, I'm
asking. I mean, I don't have all the details from Ames. So, did you step down from a...
I never stepped up.
Okay. That's what I'm getting at. So, you're saying you were never a member of an SDG?
Not by validation by myself or anyone that was above reproach on that subject, sir, no.
Okay, and you're on a PCR now?
That is correct.
Why are you on a PCR now?
You mean as opposed to any other prison unit?
Yeah. Were you there for a special reason?
You were right. The officer said, get in the van, this is where you're going. Get in that cell, that's where you live.
It wasn't over an incident?
It was over many incidents, yes, sir.
Okay. Again, as I stated when I started this line of questioning, because this isn't a trial, I was just trying to understand if you were a member of an SDG and if that membership was the reason why you were transferred to a PCR. And you're saying...
There's some... Okay.
Go ahead, sir.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, sir.
I have been... No, sir. I am a prisoner and... I have been a prisoner since I got put in here, and different people have thrown my name into a hat and said, yes, this is your guy. At the same time, they have told me straight up, hey, this is going to happen to you if it doesn't happen this way. As a kid, I was, even the ones that I volunteered, that I would be like, yes, sir, I will go do that for you, sir. You're going home in 30 days. There's no way I want you to get tangled up in that. I would go get beat up or Whatever you would like, sir. To you, to me, that would mean that you are part of any kind of organization.
And
but I never signed anything. I never said, okay, if I'm on this, then I will do that for the rest of my life for you.
So, has this behavior changed in you? Are you still active with that sort of behavior?
Not on purpose. I do what I do to protect myself. I have a cellmate that I try to help out. And I live my life just like the Bible says, like one day at a time, sir.
Okay, sir. No further questions, Ms. Rittenhouse.
That's a satisfying
Mr. question. Johnson has another question.
Sir, one more question. So you went to a jury trial and you were convicted by the jury. Were you convicted of the person who actually committed the shooting in your jury trial?
That is correct. They found me guilty for pulling the trigger. That is what the charges read.
Mm-hmm.
That is not what I pled guilty to. Assumed of being found guilty of. But my lawyer, the team actually of lawyers, described to me was within the ramifications of the 25 to life, whatever that meant, clause.
All right, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Dr. Wright, did you have a question?
Yes, ma'am. That's what I should understand. Now, from your perspective, sir, not what the lawyer said, not what the court said, not what somebody else said, were you guilty of this murder, sir?
No, sir.
You still saying that you were not guilty?
Yes, sir.
So if you put on a logical hat today, why are you incarcerated, sir, if you're not guilty? In your mind,
why not
what nobody else would say, not what nobody else would say, but in your mind, why are you incarcerated, sir? This is a question. It may not sound like a question,
okay.
But you don't or do you accept any responsibility for the crime itself, sir?
At this point, I could go back and brag to 100 other people that I am the greatest marksman on the planet, but it just does not make it. So, sorry.
In your mind, have you changed since this crime was committed, since being incarcerated all these years? Are you a different person than in your mind?
I would like to believe so, honestly. I am older.
What have you done to change, sir?
Okay.
Let me just ask maybe another question or two. If you, in this question, you don't have to, you don't have to respond to it, but I just want to ask, have you had any psychological evaluation since you've been incarcerated, sir?
Yes.
And what did they find, sir?
Honestly, that was, those evaluations are up to the, I don't know if it's a physician, but those clinical terms are beyond my scope, sir.
So you're saying after all these years, you really don't know what happened. You just happened to have been there, something happened, and they said that you were guilty. So you have no idea what, I mean, this is what you're telling us. I mean, we're not a court of law, as my colleague has already said. We're not here, we're not in a court now. Anything you say cannot or will not be held against you. But you're saying to this board, you really don't know what happened. You just happened to have been there, something happened. So you were found guilty by...
I should not.
Please tell
me, sir. Yes, I can run back everything that I've learned over the years of fighting my appeal, trying to shepherdize other cases, and find out an avenue that I fit into to be able to say, this is my legal right to be not guilty. I mean, but at this point, right, it's... I honestly hope and pray that, you know, those people in the audience can understand my point of view.
We just want you to, right now, we just want you to speak to the board. We don't want you to speak to them. You just speak to the board now. So we just ask you to speak to the board, sir.
Okay. All right. Yes, sir. It's in the 5-year hands.
So let me just ask, I guess, just one other question, Honorable Ms. Rittenhouse, and that is, you seem to be, and I know this is your first time coming before this board, and we're just trying to get to know you better so we can make an informed decision, but you're being a little vague, not a little vague, you're being totally vague, therefore...
I'm sorry.
I don't quite understand exactly what you're saying or what happened in your mind, but what do you do since you've been incarcerated? Have you had any jobs, or you just sleep all day? What do you do since you've been incarcerated, sir?
I'm sorry, yes, sir. That is pretty much it. I am working. I have a kitchen position that I am a kitchen helper. I try to make it easier on those citizens that come in to get the animals fed and get them on their way back to help their loved ones.
What kind of animals do you get fed, sir? I'm sorry, sir.
Just the mammal that you see in front of you, sir.
Okay, sir. The reason I ask that question, I know they don't pay you that much, you know, for whatever you do there, but has it ever been deducted for restitution, sir?
Yes, sir, and has been cured for more because of my disciplinary record, sir.
Okay, sir. Thank you so very much. Thank you, Madam Rittenhouse. Thank you, ma'am.
Any other questions from board members? Okay, Mr. Mulkey, at this point, we're going to take some testimony from some victim representatives who are here today, sir. So I'm not sure who would like to come first, or...
She'll go last, so...
Okay.
Who
little slow.
Good morning. I know my name's a lot better than we do sometimes. Could you please start by just stating your full name?
I'm Edward Henry Thacker.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for restarting this. We had a letter to us that was supposed to be between 8:30 and 10. No one, we're trying to get this straightened out.
Well, we had 11 and 12:30, so see?
I know. So there was definitely confusion by whatever part. Hopefully we'll be able to get this taken care of anyway.
Let me just say this, sir, before you go any further. On behalf of the board, we sincerely apologize for the mix-up with the timing. I don't know what happened there. I have zero idea, because what we usually do, we do not give a time. We kind of leave it open, because we don't know how long other hearings are going to take. Therefore, to you and everyone else, on behalf of the board, I sincerely apologize for the mix-up in terms of the time.
We thank you for that, because we had no idea either. It was just one of those things. Now that we've been made aware of it, that it can take from 8:30 till whatever
to time. 5 o'clock.
We'll understand that, but we had no idea either. But
thank you.
I want to start by telling you my date on that particular day. June 29th, 1994. I was working in Western Kansas. Redoing a roof and a couple of buildings, because I'm a contractor, and that time I was subbing. Worked all day long. His name was Forrest Cox. Owns a lot of ranch area, a lot of wheat farming that goes on in Kansas, in those areas. And I finished my day, got my crew out there, and I get a phone call around 3 or 4 o'clock, I think, is about the time we finished up. And my men were standing around, and when I got up off the floor, they asked me what happened. I told them my father had been murdered. From that time, I really thought we kind of had zoned in on a person that had been really agitated with my father. And thank God that my uncle called me, who's a pastor, also like my father. Said, don't go to Arizona without your family. Because in those situations, you have this upheaval of anger and lots of other emotions that go in on you. So I listened to his counsel, which is probably one of the very few times I've ever listened to anybody in my life. But I did. Thank goodness I did. Went home, gathered my family, drove to Arizona to be with my family to see, because I just couldn't believe it. I could not believe that he was gone. So much so that I had to go with my sister and my mother to the funeral home. They asked us to sign a paper so that I could see him, because I had to be sure that day. And we seen him, and it was him, on a cold gurney with a white sheet, with a hole through his eye. He was alive, you know, he was alive the last time that I had spoke with him, and here I'm standing at a morgue with a man laying there that had he rode a horse from Chicago, Illinois, to California, preaching the gospel. Because he made a commitment to God that if this man ever was to see salvation, Lord, I'll get on a horse, I'll ride from here to California and back, and I'll preach. He had a commitment. I hope I have the same commitment to honoring him every time that this comes up, that he had for me and for other people. I'm not going to belabor, because I'm sure we've got other people to be able to speak more at the time. But I do know the only way for reform is to own up to what you did. Thank you. were taught that, and hopefully everyone in this room has been taught that from little on. We know that you have to be accountable for what you've done for any restitution to be able to begin. I know that my own life, until I said I did this, there was no way to begin a healing process. There was no way to ever have restitution in your life. Restitution has never come to our family by way of letters, by way of asking. I don't know if that's allowed or not. I do not know. I know that there's a new system now in the state of Arizona that started here recently to be able to have that dialogue with the victims and the perpetrators. And I think that's going to be something that will be very helpful for other people in the future. I truly do. I wish it could have started 25 years ago. I really, truly do. I'll tell you one thing, that after listening to this conversation that we've had, to make sure that you understand, in this particular trial that we had gone through, I think it was only the second time it had been performed in the state of Arizona, where you had two victims accusing each other and having two separate trials at the same time, simultaneously with the same jury. It was very different. We've looked into that, and I think it had been done in the early 1900s. Don't know if it was because of money or because of timing, and I'm going to say it probably was both, more than likely. But through that, I can tell you one thing that I'll never forget. The statement was made by both of these that were accused. On separate trials, individually set, and I don't think that anyone would have the opportunity to forget this. When they came, they said that one was on one end of the car and one was on the other end of the car. Both of them testified to that. Both of them testified against each other, saying, after they said to him, obviously they wanted him to get on his knees. You think about that statement. Then he turned to them and he said, "Boys, you don't have to do this. Boys, you don't have to do this." If there was any other time during that day that they had an opportunity to make a choice, when that particular moment brought them to that point, you get to make a choice once again. He gave them the choice, showed them the choice. They didn't choose the right one. They didn't choose not to do this. They didn't choose to say, "I want help." They didn't choose to run. They didn't choose not to take the car. They didn't choose not to take the money. They didn't choose not to go to some girlfriend's house. They didn't choose not to try to run and leave the state lines. All those choices. But it came down to the one thing, and I'm going to ask you guys the same thing, the words that he used. You don't have to do this to let him out. You don't have to. I know you come from different walks of life, thank goodness, because it gives us a rounded body of intelligent people, because you need to have that. But I'm going to ask you, you don't have to do this. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. questions from board members?
I would like to take this time, though, to say that, I mean, as an independent voting board member, every case that I look at, I'm going to look at the whole of the case, and I'm going to do my part on behalf of the people of Arizona. But there was much wisdom in what you had to share today, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Welcome. Please, yeah, I know it is afternoon already. Could you just please state your name before you start? Mr. Attorney, can you remember? I think you realize
that I was sincere. And we had a long conversation. He had a rough childhood, but he also hurt animals when he was young. He was just this person. Seemed destined to fail. And I see today he's still struggling and not accepting any responsibility for any of this, which is hard and sad. He had many opportunities. He actually had the gun in his hand and decided to shoot it. At that point, I made a phone call. He was concerned for his life and in jeopardy. He had taken an opportunity in the house they broke into to make that phone call. I mean, he had a weapon. He was in control. He was in charge. Could have changed it all if he truly was a victim in all of these circumstances. So his remark about hitchhiking to get away, they were hitchhiking because the second car they stole in Texas blew up at a gas station where they were stealing gas. And bullets in his pocket were hollow point bullets. My dad didn't have a chance. We all know how hot Arizona summers are, and when I went back to the place where they had shot him, there was so much blood still. It was the cow. And his face, Ed and I were the ones who went to the morgue to identify him, and it was the document when he signed was that we wouldn't sue them for what we were about to see. We lived in a retirement community, and so there's a lot of death. And my dad's face was unrecognizable. And the man who ran the butchery that we knew most of our life growing up there came out of retirement to try to fix his face. Mr. B thinks he's in prison for not telling him when he was fast enough. In the palm of your hand. Oh, my father's life was in the palm of yours. I tried to ask the judge 25 years ago if I could take 7 years of smoking for one day and just go through the basis of what my dad did, fixing military stance, moving on the church, just little odd jobs you do as a pastor in a kind of small retirement town. And was told that the cost of security would be too much and we couldn't do that. So I said, what if I pay for it? And they still said no. But I think at 20 years old, maybe he would have known my dad's eyes were hazel. Maybe he would know my dad played the guitar. maybe we would rail. Maybe we would take it a moment to start accepting responsibility for being there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Please state your name, please.
Good afternoon, I'm Tim Thacker. I see it's almost lunchtime. Hope you guys aren't thinking about that too much. I do appreciate your willingness to do a job like this. And I apologize for my entrance. I did not. I wanted to make sure that my anger was in the right direction, not at you. What I heard today, Mr. Mulkey, if you're listening.
I am.
Because you have no...
Everybody needs to address the board, please.
I'm addressing the board. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I've waited 25 years. I wanted to hear the truth. What we saw on trial, in the split trial, split jury, crazy, was each other pointing the fingers at each other. Nobody did it. 25 years later, I blinked, and nobody still did it. This is completely a different story than we told, than was told in the trial. I don't recognize this. I distinctly remember showing up to every hearing and listening to everything. You don't forget things like that. You don't forget when somebody lies to you about the death penalty, because I believe the death penalty still, and I'm a Baptist preacher, I believe that under the Abrahamic covenant, if you shed a man's blood, by man, your blood will be shed. That's where we're at. Now I realize that, you know, some say, well, that's under the law, that was before the law. And I would have voted for that, because I'll tell you what, they both were guilty. They're both pointing the finger, and what I hear today is a man who has absolutely nothing to do with anything that happened. Now, somebody that's living in a delusional mindset as that cannot be released. You could not, in good conscience, release somebody that says he had not. He said that he did not. He never saw the body. He was a quarter mile away. Guess what? I was a quarter mile away building a house for my father. He was coming up to see it. A house that he was going to live in. I heard the shot. I found the body. Friend, and I'll tell you what, it took 2 years to drag him as far as he did off the road. They drug his teeth out like a dog. And he didn't call the police in time. He didn't give his story in first. That's delusional. And I will be here for every hearing, friends. That's the least I can do. I'm going to save some time for my mother.
Any questions for Mr.
I do, sir. Let me just apologize, at least for myself, because we do understand, and you know, I can't say we can have that same feelings, but we do understand the victims. And it was really my understanding that we were doing all that we could to provide the service. I apologize for the miscommunication that we actually had, but the rearranging and the rescheduling was a miscommunication. And I'm telling you, I sincerely and honestly believe that we were doing the best through that communication, and that miscommunication is on our behalf. So I'm apologizing to you and your mother, but I'm apologizing to you because I can understand, you know, you're being upset coming in.
We've been doing it over 4 hours.
Yes, sir. I do understand that. So I do want to offer that to you and your mother, because it was a misunderstanding that we actually had, and that it was not your fault, and your mother's absolutely right. I would want you, and we would, as a board, always try to make sure that the victims are here during that hearing. So I just wanted to I just wanted to say that we mean no disrespect to you or your family.
Thank you.
May I add something to this? It's just to echo a little bit of what my colleague just said. So maybe on a personal level, because as I stated, we're all independent board members. I didn't understand the emotion that was walking into the room at that moment. I do now. And I thank you for the way you've addressed the board.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Could you please just state your name to start?
I'm Victoria Thacker.
Thank you.
I do apologize. Well, I don't know why there was so much misunderstanding. I do appreciate Alex. He's been a great help. I'm with this fortune because I called him everything there was to call him about, and he did his best to respond, because when I called his office, this very office, nobody answers the phone. Are you aware of that? Nobody answers the phone. It goes to, you can push number one for this, number two for this, number three for this, and zero for the operator. I went through them all, recalling the phone number, and when I hit the zero for the operator, they said, you had the wrong number, and hung up on me. So it was very discouraging. So I did call the governor's office, and I explained that I can't get anybody to tell me this letter they sent me in order to make this appointment or find out when this day is that we need to be here. And I finally got a call from Alex, and I don't know how that transpired. If it was just an automatic thing where the governor's office got a hold that I was upset. I'm going to be 77 years old, and I didn't want to face this. I didn't want to go through this. I wanted somebody to help me, tell me what day this was going to be, what time it was going to be. I didn't want to have to go to a website that they repeated so fast in my hearing aids, and I couldn't catch it. I didn't know my children were coming. They did not notify me. I sent them emails about this because they have a right to know. They have a right to be here. But they did not receive letters as victims. I was the only one in the room that received a letter that I'm aware of. And I made sure they knew, but they did not know that they were attending. We did not drag our feet to make it miserable for them. Or they knew they had to go early, and we didn't know we were on the road. We could have gone earlier if we had gone. I prepared a few thoughts. On June 28th, 1994, the day before my husband was murdered, was my wedding anniversary. I was married 38 years at that time. We decided not to celebrate it that day. It wasn't a convenient day. We always think we have more time than we do, folks. So we thought we could wait till the weekend and do that. The following day, on June 29, 1994, my husband began his morning by making sun tea, fully expecting he would return home later that day to drink. My husband had a list of things he needed to accomplish that day, so he left home early. My plan for the day was to drive to Douglas, which is about 40 miles from where we live. I wanted to purchase a new comforter and some curtains and things to fix up our bedroom, because it was our anniversary, you know. When I returned home from Douglas, as soon as they turned into my garage, I always look in my rearview mirror to make sure I don't shut the garage door too soon. And I see a police car. And I knew to stand there. I don't know why. I just got out of the car, didn't go in the house. I just stood there. And Jim, the last speaker came into their garage and he says, "Now I've got to tell you something." And walked into the house and he said, "Dad is dead. He was shot." My mom couldn't accept what he was telling me. How could this possibly be? Where, when, what? He said he was killed on the Cochise Stronghold Road.
The Cochise Stronghold Road is where our youth camp was located for years. We knew everybody up and down that road. It was a dead-end road. I couldn't compute in my mind. Countless times we've driven up and down that road. For years, my husband would hook up an old yellow truck to a huge wagon and we'd pull along. It was full of kids and we'd pull them up and down the road and they'd be laughing and singing and having a great time. And Broken Arrow Camp was dedicated to reaching kids for Christ. Our desire was just to not let them get on the wrong path, to do right, to live right. That was our direction. At dawn the following day, I wanted to see the place my husband was killed. So Tim and I headed for the stronghold. Amazingly, large portions of blood was still all over the ground, even though it had been hours prior to that he was murdered. And I thought, it must be because the ground was so hard because the monsoons hadn't come yet in June. It's really hot. The actual reason was the amount of blood was due to the size of the handgun used, the type of bullet, and he was shot at point-blank range, which made him fall forward. That's when his teeth were broken, I suppose. We found pieces of his teeth laying on the ground when his body was drug off the road. The amount of blood on the ground was caused by the used bullet in his head. I bent down and I put my hand in his blood, trying to comprehend what took place. As my daughter says, we planned the funeral. We were warned both by the police officers as well as the funeral director about an open casket. But since my husband and I met at the age of 13, and I married him when I was 16, and he's the only person, only man I ever told I loved. There's no circumstances that was going to prevent me from seeing him. The undertaker did his best, trying to disguise the whole. It didn't work, folks. It didn't matter. It was obvious what horror he faced the last minutes of his life. The car which he had been driving was nowhere to be found. Neither was his wallet. So on June 29th, my husband was murdered. He was robbed. His car was stolen. On a side note, in his car was a briefcase that contained every important paper we had, every certificate, document, deed, corporation paper, tax forms, you name it, it was in there. All those papers were strung out the window on Highway 191 heading south toward Mexico, which caused our family a lot of grief. This is what happened in one day. It went downhill from there. We live 126 miles round trip from the courthouse. I attended every proceeding that ever took place, any motion, anything that went on that was down that road. It didn't matter if I barely could put one foot in front of the other. It didn't matter if I had money for the gas tank. It didn't matter if I was sick. I attended. Anytime I was allowed to speak and have an impact statement, I did. Finally, our family, it was time for the trial, and we were subjected to almost 3 weeks of a murder trial, which was almost unbearable. There are no words to express what this did to our family. The broken hearts, the broken dreams, and the pain of living 24 hours without the person you love. As a mom, I wanted to comfort my children, but I was just unable. My sorrow was so deep. The families of crime are victims, choosing none of these for themselves. We bear the brunt of what someone else chose for us. We have to march to the drumbeat of the criminal justice system. Whatever day they say to arrive, whatever time they decide to arrive, everything is decided for us. You're thinking, he's in jail, or Eric's having to go to the drumbeat. The victims are part of that drumbeat. Do you understand? I didn't choose this day. I didn't choose this time. I didn't choose this mess up with the family. But here we are. Nothing is done for the accessibility or convenience to the victim. This trip here today was one I didn't want to make. We had to drive, we're to be driving hundreds of miles by the time we go back and forth. I have to be here. I have to be here. I have no choice in my heart. Ain't Eric made a lot of decisions on June 29th, 1994, as well as AJ, the other person involved in this. Eric chose to murder. He chose to rob. He chose to steal. By the way, I'm going to kick this tire as I go down the road, as my husband used to say. The gun didn't do it. It's an inanimate object. It takes a person to pick it up. It takes a person to pull that trigger. Choices have consequences. I've learned that through my life. I made some bad choices in my life. I'm sure all of us in this room could attest to that. And we have to pay the consequences for what we do, what we choose in life. When you choose to murder someone, you choose the consequences that go along with it. The jury found him guilty. The judge sentenced him to life in prison. This decision was already made that he should stay in jail for life. I'm not going to put that on the weight of that on me also with all the weight I've been carrying. I'm just not going to do it. I'm going to put the weight on you to do the right thing. And I think you know what that is. And if he truly had a repentant heart, he'd never make this family go through this again. He'd say, I'm going to wait anytime they ask me. Because I should get out of jail. Thank you for listening to me.
Any questions?
Thank you, ma'am. You know, again, I also want to offer my apology. I just, of the misunderstanding, I feel bad because of the misunderstanding or the miscommunication, but I do understand that sometimes we do make every effort as far as the court goes to accommodate the victim, the victim's family. So it was just a miscommunication, so I take responsibility because I was the one responsible for making the decision at that time, but again, I understand and I do.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today.
All right, Mr. Mulkey, we're coming up toward the end of your hearing, but I want to give you the opportunity, if you'd like, to make a final statement. Is there anything else you'd like to tell the board?
No, ma'am, this time.
Okay.
I've already given everybody that let me know that this was supposed to be happening sometime this month. Addresses for health insurance, for restitution, insurance, or I mean, no, thank you.
All right, thank you, sir. Mr. Mulkey, the board is going to go into discussion. We do all of our discussion in public under the Arizona Open Meeting Law. So we have not discussed this case as a board until this moment, until this hearing. So we just ask that you and folks present just remain silent and listen to the discussion, and we'll be back with you in just a moment. The board is now in discussion.
And you're welcome to stay on the phone if you want to, sir. You don't have to hang up. It's left up to you.
All right. So the board is now in discussion. Mr. Mulkey was involved in this crime, clearly, and isn't really able to articulate his involvement. This is his first hearing before the board, and I can tell it's very emotional for him and for everyone. But I'm just not, I'm not hearing an accounting of what happened that day. And I, you know, as a very basic, I think an individual needs to be able to say what happened, and I'm not hearing that. So I'm not hearing it, sort of seeing him as a good candidate for parole at this point. But I would listen to any input from fellow board members. Mr. Quinones.
Thank you, Ms. Rittenhouse. I'm going to fundamentally echo what you're saying, but let me begin by saying that I don't know what is in the heart or mind of Mr. Morgan, but I find his response is evasive, and I can't help but feel as there are large holes in the accounting of this instant offense. And like you, I don't find him a suitable candidate for supervised release.
Mr. Johnson?
And I agree. I agree with my colleagues. Without making any further comments, just find the statements just so inconsistent and of what he's saying. And really, I see no remorse for the actions that he was involved in.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any other, Mr. Neal?
On that same line, I mean, basically, I agree with my colleagues all the way around, but on that same line with Mr. Johnson, is the remorse. He's quick to say he didn't do it, but he was present. Sometimes he was present, but we've had numerous inmates come in that were convicted of felony murder. They didn't pull the trigger, but they had a tremendous amount of remorse for the crime that occurred and the loss of life by the time they've done this one time. Yeah. And I don't see that at all. I don't see remorse for the crime occurring, for the victim being killed, regardless of who pulled the trigger. There's just nothing there other than I didn't do it.
Thank you, sir. Dr. White?
Just real simple, not in favor of general parole, absolute discharge or home arrest.
All right, then I'm going to make a motion that we deny general parole, absolute discharge or home arrest for Eric Mulkey. And based on the date of the crime, I would request a one-year set-off for the next hearing.
Agreed.
Motion by myself, seconded Mr. Johnson. Agreed, Dr. White, Mr. Neal, Mr. Quinones. Released and denied general parole, absolute discharge or home arrest, and reason for denial: serious and violent offense, loss of human life, trauma to the victim, serious bodily injury, victim harassment, and I'm saying that because of him having to be on his knees. I'm going to just put recent disciplinary because we had discipline from 15, which is fairly recent. No family or community support system, and that may be because this is Mr. Mulkey's first hearing. He's not aware that he could have people here for him. And poor or no release plan. Would there be anything else that board members want to add? Okay. All right, back to you, Mr. Mulkey. The board has denied your parole, general parole, or absolute discharge or home arrest at this time. And did you hear the reasons for denial, sir?
The only thing I can think to say is I apologize to the victims for having to drive over this way and have to wait another year.
Well, Mr. Mulkey, the board will, the department will certify you in approximately a year to come back before the board, and we'll conduct another hearing at that time, sir. So thank you very much for participating today. Thank you to everyone who drove and flew and whatever, traveled here for this hearing. And the hearing is concluded at this time. Mr. Mulkey, if you'd give the phone back to the CO3, we'd appreciate it. Or just lay it down. Thank you.